Hello and welcome to episode number 68 of the At U2 podcast, where we talk all things U2, new album news, tour dates, and community discussions from the staff of atu2.com. You can find links to what we discuss in this episode at goodstuff.fm/atu2/68. On this episode, we're devoting our entire hour to an interview with Neil McCormick, who is the Daily Telegraph's chief pop and rock music critic. He is an author, radio pundit, and television presenter, and I guess he can add podcast guest to that resume now, I suppose, with his own Music Weekly interview show, Neil McCormick's Needle Time, broadcast on Vintage TV. In his own words, none of this, however, remotely compensates for being a failed rock star, haunted by witnessing his friend Bono rise to global superstardom. We talked with Neil about his book, Zero, which he is crowdfunding support for, and he shares where he drew inspiration for his story of a lost boy trying to escape from himself in the full glare of modern media. Let's jump right into our conversation with Neil McCormick.
You're the song. I mean, is he taking a piss now or what? He still hasn't found what he's looking for. He has got everything he ever wanted.
Well, welcome to the podcast, Neil. It's great to have you on the show to talk about your book and about your connection to U2, I guess, is the obvious one for the podcast, but since this is the U2 podcast, but just fun music history that you have connections to. But so before we get any further, I just want to let people know you can, the one of the reasons Neil's on the show is to talk about his book, like I said, that he's doing crowdfunding for, which you can visit unbound.com/books/zero to support. Get your copy, pick one of the reward levels, which we'll talk about in a bit. And so even while you're listening to the sounds of us talking, you can go visit that site and get in the queue to get your copy of Zero when it comes out. So the book is titled #Zero. And so if I just wanted to know, I guess, where and who is Zero in the world today?
It's called #Zero because, you know, hashtags are the modern thing, so the kids tell me. Zero is a pop star. He's a fictional pop star. I wanted to write about fame. I wanted to write about many things, family, really, psychology, creativity. But through the bubble of fame, which is this modern-day ultra obsession, we see fame destroying lives, destroying psyches. We see it as, you know, a poisonous, toxic substance. That's pretty clear. And yet, you know, our society still seems to crave it, this selfie society that we have. And I wanted to be able to write about that. And, you know, I know pop music. I know the music business. I have been behind the cordon, you know, because of my friendship with U2, which goes back to my school days. I have, you know, been behind the cordon of superstardom, where you can see the machine that operates, that creates this bubble around people. And I've seen that with them. And now I've seen it from the other side as a, you know, as a musician in a struggling band and as a journalist writing about bands, interviewing. And I've got just so much information about the kind of character and texture of all of this that it just seemed the right mise en scène for me to write about.
In the fictional world, I guess, crossing over to the real world somehow, would Zero even want to work with U2, or is U2 too old and too of a different era that his ego is too big for Bono even?
His ego is pretty big, I have to say, but his ego is big in the way that egos in pop music often are big and fragile, big because they are actually they're kind of an ego plastered over the problems of an id. They are, you know, beneath the self-aggrandizing pomp is just fear and loss and absence. You know, this is a conversation that I've had with Bono many times. It's the conversation that we're having in Killing Bono. It's a conversation we return to in U2 by U2, which is about the black hole, the need for unconditional love of strangers that drives so much stardom. And Zero has got that. But he does come across U2 in the book. He does come across Bono. In my original draft of this book, which I've spent quite a long time writing in different iterations, it was completely in a metafictional universe, and Zero was the only fictional pop star in it. Everybody else was real. You know, I had populated it with all the artists of the day. That proved slightly problematic because, for one thing, the artists of the day are constantly changing. And so, you know, if you're writing a draft and Jessie J is a big pop star at that moment and you slip her in, and then by the time you finish the draft, people are going, who the heck is Jessie J? and there's somebody else. I also, you know, I started to feel that I got morally queasy about inventing scenes for real people. I feel it's a kind of dubious area that we do get into, this metafiction that goes on now. But so I started to think, well, the way to do that is to invent my own pop universe, which made the whole thing far more fun because I could think up, you know, my own new metal band, my own, you know, pop starlet, my own old blues man. But what I couldn't really think was my own superstars that sort of populate the fabric, who, when you say their name, you just know who they are, like Madonna, like Elton, and like Bono. And I figured I had to have some of them in there. And so I thought Bono was the safest choice because he'd be the least likely to sue me. But I also threw in Elton and Sting because, you know, personally, I've got on with them very well. But actually, I took out a couple of others, like Madonna, because I think, you know, you've got a good chance that if they don't like the way they portrayed you, that there'll be a legal notice on your doorstep that I just can't afford.
That's not one of the reward levels, is get to see Neil at in court with, yeah, Madonna. Court. Right.
Yeah. In court with Madonna, though, would be quite a good, I'd go and see that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm curious whether we're sort of talking about Zero as if he is this real pop star, but in today's climate, one of the things that pop stars are either encouraged to do or discouraged to do, depending on your slant, is getting involved in politics and things like that. And does Zero get involved in that, or is that sort of an area you steer clear of in his story?
No, he's way too narcissistic and self-involved. And in fact, there is, you know, it starts around this moment when there is this charity single being recorded for the victims of a natural disaster. And Zero, he's doing it because he's supposed to do it, because you have to do it, because everybody does it, but he hates it. He thinks it's a complete, you know, it's taking away from his moment in the limelight because he has to sing for all these orphans. It's a kind of different way of looking. He's a pretty obnoxious character, I have to say, but it's about a journey from obnoxiousness. And in some ways, I wanted to make him about as offensive as I could. And in my original draft, I probably made him too offensive. People were reading it with a slight horror and shock. And I did a reading of this along the way when I was at a university in America, a college in America, doing some lecturing, and I read from the draft of my book, and I could see the jaw gaping horror of people who'd come along to the reading. So I had to get in there and tone that, because I actually like this character. I think these damaged people that make pop music, that fill our pop landscape, are, you know, they are often nursing a wound that is what they need to express in art. It's what they need to do to heal them. And, you know, they sing because it's a matter of life and death to them. And that is actually why you hear it in their voices, and it's why some of these more brittle and damaged characters are actually such great pop stars and artists. Now, I'm not saying Bono's that, but he's coming out of that place of pain, and that's what makes him such a great singer and communicator, you know, because he needs to do it.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, he's definitely been very public in terms of when he's singing about or writing about the pain of losing his mother as a child and things like that, and definitely comes from that place. And whether it's required almost in a sense to have something, some deep hurt like that, that you're working through to be in pop or in art, I guess, is it?
I don't know if it is absolutely required. I think maybe you can be a complete genius. You know, I don't know what the deep hurt would be in Bob Dylan. He seems to have come from a fairly secure background, for example. You know, we don't know necessarily if you know, Shakespeare or Michelangelo were carrying deep hurt. I think you can be an artist without it, just because your creativity is triggered on some higher level. But I do think art is often the healing balm of psychological wounds, and the artists are not therefore the most well-balanced people, great artists maybe, but, you know, they need that extra edge. Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about this because St. Vincent's got an album out this week, which I've been reviewing, and to me it is easily her best album, because it's the one where all her kind of quirkiness has been folded into songs that have emotional resonance. And why is that? Because it's about breaking up with her girlfriend. And, you know, you wouldn't go around wishing that upon somebody, but it does seem to, you know, those breakup albums do seem to produce a kind of pinnacle art for a lot of people. You know, pain is what we solve with art.
Yeah, before Adele's new album came out, everyone was wondering, who is she breaking up with in order to have material for this or whatever. And I even remember back to my youth and getting into bands like Guns N' Roses and then hearing him talking about the pain of his mother or whatever, and thinking, or maybe his dad, I can't remember, but I remember as a teenager thinking, oh, I kind of wish I had something deeper, some deeper, like I needed this or whatever. And then, yeah, learning about Bono and et cetera.
My mother used to, when she read Killing Bono, she said, oh, do you think we should have treated you worse? Would that have made you a rock star?
Exactly. That's it. You can see the mixed up logic, I guess, in our youth, in wishing for more pain, I guess, and somehow.
People say to me quite often, because of Killing Bono, oh, you would like to be Bono, wouldn't you? You would like his life. I say, I would not like to be Bono. No, I wouldn't mind living in his house. But, you know, I sleep well at night.
When you're talking about reading the draft, I guess, to folks in the university, does it present itself in an interesting way? Because they're picturing, I guess, I'm picturing myself listening to you reading it and thinking, okay, I know he knows Bono. I know he knows some other celebrities. This is based on Bono's real life, obviously, or like, you know, how I might interpret it, I guess, hearing you read it. And is that sort of where some of that reaction maybe came from? That obviously, like you've said, it's pulled probably from many your experiences with musicians across many genres, and not just obviously pulled from Bono's diary or whatever.
Well, you know, it's not pulled from Bono at all, because he's, you know, he found and you two found in certain. I think it's quite interesting what kept them sane in this, and I think partly, you know, it's being in a group and not being a solo artist. I was just watching a documentary that's coming out next week of George Michael that he made himself. And he was talking about how fame was easy to handle when he was in Wham. But when he was out on his own, there was no one to turn to keep his feet on the ground, to sort of laugh it off. The hysteria became terrifying. And it really struck me. He talked about how, as a pop star, as a young, he wanted to join, you know, he had an ambition that he could see that he could become one of these 80s iconic figures that bestraddled pop in the 80s. That was Madonna, Prince, Michael Jackson. and then George Michael. And I thought to myself, wow, he didn't even know this when he's talking, and because he is obviously was still alive when he was making the documentary. But actually, Madonna is the only one of those people still alive. Mm-hmm. They all died in their 50s. You know, Whitney Houston's gone. But the people who in the bands, the iconic figures from the bands, you know, Morrissey and Sting and Bono, who were, you know, similar kind of superstar figures, they're still with us. Because I think a band protects you. You know, there's a number of you to deflect and the attention to absorb it together. So there's that. Plus, of course, their religious belief was so strong and profound for three of them at the time that it meant that they missed all the kind of nefarious sex, drugs, and rock and roll stuff that drags people off, you know, off the path and wears down their energy and knocks them around. And by the time they got around to that, you know, so with Achtung Baby and Pop, they were already, you know, mature, married with kids, and you know, they were very grounded. So there's not really a lot of Bono or you know, Larry for that matter, who went through similar painful background in there. You know, the character that I've created is much more of a volatile character. It's much more Robbie Williams than Bono, and but it is very much a character that I feel, in, you know, when you're a writer, they start, you don't just take a bunch of ticks from people that you've observed. You take a bunch of ticks from yourself and from all the things around you, and you start to mold a character, and then they just start to have a life on the page. And that's the great fun of fiction. You're not tied to what people actually did and what actually happened. And the book really, you know, I had a premise, but it rattled off. It went places that I didn't expect it to go. It was great fun to write, but it ended up somewhere, you know, that was completely different from the model that I had set out. You know, I set out a plan, but this character wanted to do other things. And so to me, Zero became somebody so complete in themselves that I can't really think of them in terms of being modeled on another pop star. However, some of the fun you might have reading it is that all of the other pop stars in the book are modeled on somebody else, quite specific, as they flit in and out. I think, ooh, what would you know? Actually, Beyonce's not in there, but what would Beyonce be? What would be a good name for Beyonce? What would she be like, for example? Or I might have written, you know, a scene for Chris Martin, and then think, uh-oh, there's a lawsuit. So, you know, they transpose into someone else. So you can maybe pick those characters out at your pleasure.
That's what I've often heard writers and even songwriters too talk about, that idea of a character almost coming to life in there, whether it's, I don't know, in your mind, you're picturing them, or you know, maybe some of the drug induced writers where it's they're sitting beside you. But at what point in the writing process, I'm curious about what point does that character come to life? Like how early in the process, I guess, did Zero almost, you know, sort of appear to you and sort of come off the page, as it were?
Well, you know, very early in the process. Funny enough, I wrote the first chapter I wrote, and I showed it to my agent, and she liked it and said, yeah, I think this is a great idea. This is where to go. And the chapter was about the character in his childhood. It was a memory of something that happened. And by the time I had written the book, That chapter shaped the idea of the character. But by the time I had written my first draft, I thought, you know, that is completely and utterly extraneous. That chapter was written by me, for me, to shape the character that I'm dealing with. And I really felt for him by the time I'd written that. And my agent felt for him, and people that read it felt for him. But it had nothing to do with the story. It was just, I realized afterwards, a character sketch. So I crumpled it up. And you know, I Killed My Darling, which is what writers are always being told to do. Kill your darlings, you know. It was a piece of writing that was important to me, but was extraneous to the novel. So he came alive very quickly and probably gave me the wherewithal and the energy to write this, because it's quite hard. You know, I'm a guy who writes all the time. I write for a living. I write about music. I write for the newspapers. In the modern day, as the media environment has accelerated and we're all operating at the speed of Twitter, and the newspapers I write for are being crushed by the huge online forces of fake news and Facebook and free journalism. So we get paid less to do more. And my volume of writing over this period, this past 10 years, has leapt up. At the same time, you know, I'm a full-time father, and that was going on. And I've written my own Killing Bono book and the YouTube by YouTube book. And to sort of put all that aside, I'm going out to gigs at night and I'm consuming music all the time. And then think, right, I've done a long day. I've just written this and I've written that and I've written the other. So what am I going to do now? I'm going to sit down and write a book. It's a bit mad, really. And in order to do that, even as slowly as I've done it, I had to care about this character. I had to want him to exist on the page. It had to be a pleasure and fun thing to write. So instead of it being a drudge to turn the computer screen back on, I could, you know, it got to the point where I could hardly wait to do so.
How do you start to write a book? Was this book different than the nonfiction you've written in how you scripted it?
When I'm writing a piece of nonfiction, which is what I'm writing most of the time, I quickly sketch out, usually very quickly. It used to take me a long time, but it's very fast now. I sketch out, you know, what's the beginning, what's the middle, and what's the end? What are the points I want to make? And I might sketch that out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and bang, that's my little roadmap. And I follow that roadmap. It can change, but, you know, I've got a little roadmap, and I'm working on that. And I'm bound by, if it's an interview, I'm bound by the quotes, you know, I'm bound by the facts, the stuff that I need to include. With a piece of fiction, you are, obviously operating on a completely blank page. But, you know, in some ways, I went through the same process of sketching out a roadmap in my head. And I built, I think, an entire edifice, you know, a framework that that carried me from beginning to middle and end in my head before I wrote down a single word. I was just constructing my fictional universe idly, whilst usually, you know, last thing at night whilst lying in bed, which I don't actually recommend because it just keeps you up all night. and creating this scenario, I knew what the idea was. I knew what the theme was that I wanted to write about, because it was a lot to do with the theme that I had been writing about in Killing Bono. And you know, I had this idea of the pyramid theory of success, which was that, you know, for everyone on the pinnacle, you know, the success is shaped like a pyramid and there's more and more people holding them up until you get to the bottom, the widest level of the pyramid. And in fact, I think my first notes for the whole book was that the title was The Pyramid Theory. Killing Bono is written from the perspective of somebody who's at the bottom of that pyramid. And Zero is written from the perspective of somebody who's at the top of the pyramid, you know, looking down in a state of nausea. Because as we have seen around us, we all know, you know, it's not even the vaguest secret, you know, fame is an appalling thing for the human spirit. It's just, nobody should be famous. Never wish this upon your child. So, you know, I knew what I wanted to write about, and I sketched in my head. But when I started writing, you know, something strange and wonderful happened, which is that the book just expanded. It didn't follow my map. It was nice to have a roadmap, but, you know, in this fictional world as opposed to the non-fictional world, I didn't have to follow the roadmap. I didn't have to follow the facts. If I wanted it to change direction, I could just change direction. The characters could say what I wanted them to say instead of what, you know, the people in real life had said to me. And that each, just like in the way we live our life, things just bounced off each other and ricocheted. And it just took on a life and a journey of its own, which was, you know, tremendously fun to write. I mean, there were times when I was sitting writing in a kind of dizzy daze of happiness, chuckling, you know, laughing at my own joke because I hadn't heard them before. You know, they were coming out of these characters' mouths. And so it was, in that way, it was a tremendously different experience of writing, and always felt energizing instead of depleting.
That's great. So do you think you'll do more fiction again, since it was that much fun?
Yeah, well, you know, I've already written another novel, which I am really happy with, but I wanted to give this one a chance to breathe before I push that out into the world, because, sure, you know, I don't like, you know, nothing great ever came of keeping something in a drawer. That's right. What I've found. I've made a lot of music over the years that I didn't put out for one reason or another. And then when I did put out an album, finally, as The Ghost Who Walks, all these songs and music I had recorded that I hadn't put out, suddenly I put it out into the world. And it's not that it set the world on fire or made me a star or anything, but it was out in the world. And people started to come back to me about this song or that song, that they loved it. But also, Mel Gibson somehow got a copy of that album. And he loved it. And so then I ended up getting a call from Mel Gibson's office asking me if he could use one of the songs in a film. And, you know, that was just amazing. Because if that song had been in my desk drawer still, it would never have, that moment would never have happened. And it ended up on, you know, a compilation album that Mel Gibson put out. The song was Harm's Way. It was the compilation album was Songs Inspired by the Passion of the Christ. And it ended up there between, you know, Leonard Cohen and Nick Cave, with Bob right. Dylan bringing up the rear. And, you know, that was where I always thought I was destined to be. It's the only time I ever got into those exalted heights. And so it's about getting it out into the world where it has a chance to live in its own right.
Which kind of goes back to a question I was going to ask you about the decision to crowdfund it instead of going the traditional route of submitting it to an editor and a publishing house and et cetera. What was the sort of motivation behind doing it, I guess, in the modern era, crowdfunded way?
Well, okay. Well, let's be honest here. Nobody wanted to publish it. crowdfunding is the last resort of we scoundrels out here in writing. Actually, what happened was, if I had written this straight after I wrote I Was Bono's Doppelganger, if I had banged on and just done it, it would have been fine and it would have come out, you know, 10 years ago. But I had the idea, I started working on it, my agent was excited about it. But Bono asked me to write U2 by U2 because that project was already up and going, but they were a bit stuck, and he thought I was the person to solve that. And that was supposed to take, you know, 9 months or something. It took 2 years, you know, time trekked on, and I still hadn't written my novel. Although I talked to him about it during the experience of writing U2 by U2, which is where he came up with the title, because its original title was Motherless Child. And my agent had told me That was a bad title for a book. And for a book of this kind, because she said, oh, that's a woman's title. And, you know, you don't want a woman's title. Well, I didn't think that, but that's, I listened and, you know, I was talking to Bono about it and he said, what's the character called? And I said, Zero. And he said, that's your title right there. You know, that is a title. So I took his advice on that occasion. He had also told me to kill I Was Bono's doppelganger, to call that, sorry, Killing Bono, which is obviously good advice since that's the one that the American publisher and the filmmaker liked. So I went with that. So when I returned to writing it, and completed it, I had been out of writing for, you know, I hadn't had a book published for a few years. My agent, my publisher had changed. My editor at Penguin was gone. And I started to learn some rather harsh truths about the publishing world, which I think are, you know, I know a lot about the music world, but I had a lot to learn about the publishing world. And it's a kind of truth that upset everybody that I speak to that reads books. But when I talk to writers, they go, yeah, the publishing world is worse than the music industry. It is more genre defined. It's got a lower hit rate, something like 8% of books make a profit, and they have to pay for everything else. And it is absolutely subdivided by genre. You know, it's why when you go into not a great bookshop, but, you know, just like a standard place, a big newsagent place where they've got just the best sellers, all the covers look the same. All the fantasy books have the same cover, the same letterings, the same dragons and whatever on them. All the thrillers have the same silhouetted figure, the same lettering, the same color. Because branding is total. The only place where that doesn't exist is in literary fiction. And literary fiction, my book's not literary. You know, it's not about the high-minded ideals of language. And I started to hear people, the book was being well-received in the sense that publishers were looking at it and holding on to it and giving written reports and discussing it. And all the time I started to hear the same thing coming back, which would be people don't read books about novels about the music business. And that's because I presume that they've taken a bath on a couple of books that they've put out that haven't been a big success. And then they decide that's not a genre.
Right.
They also were saying something which is absolutely appalling. Men don't read books. The number of people that said that to me, I was shocked by, because I'm a man. And I read a lot of books. But the mass, according to the publishing industry, the mass buying public of when it comes to men, that they read nonfiction and they read genre fiction, but they don't go in for that blurring of the lines that female readers do. So they've kind of decided these things. And so my book was knocking around for a while. In the meantime, I've been writing another one. A completely different novel, which I'm really pleased with. It's been occupying me. But I've still had this book that I loved, that a lot of people that had read it, the few people that had read it loved, and that I thought was the right book for me. And somebody introduced me to Unbound. That was the DJ Simon Mayo. And Unbound are doing what crowdfunding sites have been doing in the music business for the last 10 years. You know, I've got used to crowdfunding in the music business. A lot of great records come out through crowdfunded sites by a lot of great artists. And so I spoke to them and they were keen to do it. What they do is they do a version. It's a beautifully mounted version. They have to, first of all, decide that they want to do it themselves because they don't take on everything. And their editors, they've got a company that is putting out award-winning books, but they are tied up to Penguin. And so basically they are like, you're like the indie record label that is a satellite of a major. And then when the indie has done all the work, got the book together, published it and put it out there, the major then picks it up for nothing and puts out its own version and makes all the money. So that is a long answer, but you know, it's the truth. Unbound is a fantastic place that publishes books that no one else would publish, which is kind of what a publisher should be. It's got an eclectic list of stuff that does not fit in the box. And my book apparently doesn't fit. I'm not genre. I don't fit in the box, of which I think I should be proud.
Yeah, it's a good, you can put that on your Twitter byline or whatever. Does not fit into a box or a genre. Yeah, so for folks who are interested in supporting you at, like I had mentioned earlier, unbound.com/books/0 is where you can go find out about these levels. But some of the interesting things that you, levels you chose, and I'm curious just how you decided on some of these, and maybe it was just sort of random throwing stuff up there to see what sticks for people. But of course, the basic level of £25 to get a hard copy plus an ebook, and you get your name in the back of the book. £40 for a rock and roll paraphernalia pack of 10s promo CDs that you presumably have stacks and stacks of around the office. Of interest to you two fans, maybe the £500 Killing Bono level, which doesn't allow you to kill Bono, but just is the Killing Bono book and CD, the CD that you mentioned, The Ghost Who Walks, signed copy of the U2 by U2 book that you helped write, and a bunch of other stuff. And so I guess if there's anything that you'd want to mention, I guess the other one that was kind of interesting was the £100 launch party in London, getting to sort of, there's a presumably going to be some sort of band presenting some of the songs that are written, inspired by Zero, and maybe just talk, I guess, about what that is going to look like, or how that CD is coming about, or where that music is coming from.
Yeah. Well, you know, the levels thing is that this is how you work in the area of crowdfunding. People have to pledge, and you don't really know. I mean, this is my first time doing it, and I don't really know. You kind of think, well, what are people, what can I offer? You know, I can offer a journalism masterclass, which I believe Tasula signed up for.
I sure did.
Because that's what I know. And, you know, a few people have signed up for that. And I can offer a load of memorabilia and tat that I acquire in my life because I sit in this office surrounded by stuff with new stuff coming in. Everybody sends me their records. They send me the promo material to go with the records, and I get lanyards and VIP passes as I wander about. And I've become very blasé about all of this, but I do notice that people come into the office and go, ooh, there's a 360 backstage pass. Oh, there's a Glastonbury pass from here. You know, they're quite excited about things that I take for granted. So I thought I could dish out some of that stuff. But, and that kind of memory, the promo CDs and memorabilia stuff seems to be going down very well. Nobody signed up for the Killing Bono package yet, which is a bit expensive. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have to twist Bono's arm and get him to sign the books, and then they'll be gone in a shot. I haven't asked him to do that, but I think I'm going to. He said whatever you need, so I think I need to get some Bono scribbles on things. So the launch party, obviously we're going to have a launch party. So, you know, if you want to come along, you can sign up for that. And yeah, the music, we'll be playing music there from the film, from the book. Well, the fact is, you know, I've written a book set in the pop world. It's full of lyrics, snatches of lyrics, and it's full of made up artists and song titles, which I had, you know, huge fun coming up with. But being a songwriter and a musician, it's almost impossible for me not to write down a title and a couple of lyrics and not end up strumming it on a guitar and thinking, oh, that's how that'd go. And, you know, you write a blues song, you think, oh, what would a blues song sound like? And you write a hip hop song, and then you have fun making up hip hop lyrics. And so, you know, I've got these songs, which now at the moment only exist as me strumming an acoustic guitar and tormenting my family, but I do know a lot of musicians, and I started thinking, you know, I could get this person to record that song, that would be great, and I could get that person to do this. And so in my head, I've made this record already. I haven't actually made it, but I'm going to dragoon all the talented people I know to give me their time for free and create this imaginary alternative pop soundtrack, because I can hear the songs, and now you're gonna have to. And when we get to the party, my own band Groovy Dad has volunteered their time, and the guitarist in Groovy Dad was my first reader, really. He read the book and absolutely, he was so encouraging and loved it that he sort of encouraged me to continue with it. But there's various people. I haven't asked Bono to get his kazoo out yet. You know, Bono was very, he really loved I Found God off my album. He loved that song. And he had said to me, I wrote that song. You know, he was so jealous of it in a way. Although there's plenty of his songs I feel, you know, very much the same about. But I thought it would be amazing to record I Found God with Bono singing the God parts, because people do say he thinks he's God, so it would have been his chance. But I think he felt that was a little too close to Bono, but he did say he'd come and play kazoo on it. Personally, I thought, you know, kazoo wasn't the direction that we were going in. and it probably he can't go in very many other directions these days. I think his harmonica playing is certainly better than he claims it is. I've been enjoying his harmonica playing on this tour. So, you know,
that shtick is getting old. I'll tell you. Yeah.
And is there a timeline for folks needing to get involved? Is it sort of like Kickstarter with, you know, an end date, or how does Unbound work in regards to that kind of stuff? Not obviously, well, sooner than later.
The sooner the better. You know, it's hit 52%, I think, and that's in 2.5 weeks. So it's moving along at a good pace. I mean, in fact, it's very, very high level response for Unbound themselves. So I expect and hope that we're just going to roll this ball down the hill now and get to the other 50%. But we will keep funding it then, because you could, until it comes out, you can sign up, not necessarily for some of the pledges, but which will be withdrawn, but, you know, certainly to get the book, which will be the first edition, and to come to the launch party and things like that, those will still be there. But so, you know, we can fund it more than 100%. We don't have to cut it off. But really, we need to get to that 100%, because if it doesn't get to the 100%, then it just dies. It basically says, well, there's not enough people interested at this level, then, you know, then why go further? But you know, I'm pretty confident we'll get there with them.
Good start.
It's board of readers everywhere. Anybody who likes books about music, that's what I think.
Yeah, I think that's where you're proving the publishers wrong. There aren't, particularly the men out there, I guess, if they're saying, like you said earlier, that men don't read, what was it, genre crossing fiction or something, like proves the publishers wrong. Because I know there's, I'm a man and I read that kind of book. And I know there's U2 fans who, regardless of their connection, whether there's any Bono in the book at all, which you've said there is, but the book will be interesting and fun as a fan of music, as a fan of celebrity, as a fan of just culture in general. And I think it's definitely, folks need to get out there and support stuff like this. So like I said earlier, unbound.com/books/0. We're going to keep Neil on the line until it's funded, I guess, is what we're, this is like a 24-hour fundraising effort.
Is there a way for people to buy a pledge as a gift for someone? Cause Christmas is coming up.
Indeed. That's a very good idea. You should be my marketing person, Tasula.
Well, you know, I need work. I'm out of work right now. So say the word. Yeah.
You can, of course, you can pledge in someone else's name, as well as your own, which, I do believe a couple of people have done. So, yes, of course there is. And, you know, I need to look at it and see where we're going with the pledges. And I think we could, we could, well, we'll announce this actually, because I have talked to Unbound about this. I said a lot of our support's coming from abroad, so where postage and packing is a little bit high. So I think we're going to add, and you can have this first, a Zero International promo code, which will give you 5% off.
Oh, that's cool.
If you're coming from abroad, that is as in not the UK, where the post and packaging is much cheaper.
That makes sense. I hadn't even thought about that, but people may have worried about that. So that's a good thing to bring up.
When you do the, when you have the album out, or you're putting together the album, I guess, the, of the music side of things, digital / streaming versions of that as well, sort of in the cards.
Well, the album will be an exclusive for those who care to take that particular pledge, right, with its cover and so on. But
yeah.
But some of the tracks may start to creep out in other ways. Who knows? It's all to be plotted and schemed for.
Yeah, I guess we have to. You still have to. Like you said, you've got some of the sketches of the songs in your head or on page maybe, and need to get them. Get the folks lined up with their kazoos and harmonicas to record.
They need to be damn good. That's one. I've created this character, and he's actually. A global superstar because he's so brilliant. and some of these songs have been number one smashes. So it's not like I've set myself a little task. And I've been trying to think, who do I know who can sing as well as I've described him singing? I do actually know a couple of fantastic singers. And I've got to dragoon them into it because I don't have the range to hit his notes. I'll tell you that.
You may have to schedule a tour.
Old blues man.
Yeah, if this really takes off, are you going to take Zero on tour? The album, not the book. Obviously, the book will be on tour, but.
No, you know when Killing Bono was the film was happening, there was some interest in reviving Shook Up. My brother was saying, you know, we're being offered money to go. Play some dates here, play dates there. Do you want to get the band back together? And how do you feel about that going on the road? And I said, you know, there isn't enough money. There aren't enough wild horses in the world left to drag me down a motorway in a hi-ace van to play some dodgy toilet in the middle of England. Those in my youth, I loved all that, but yeah, I have a pretty satisfying life as a writer and TV broadcaster, and you know, going out to gigs, coming home, and sleeping in my bed at night. Unless I can travel in Bono's jet. And,
and stay, I think we'd all go on tour for that.
I think the chance of me getting back out on the road are very slim.
Well, that was one of my questions, I guess, and I think you've sort of answered it in the discussion here, is when the idea of like when you've got some free time, do you reach for the pen or the guitar to relax on an evening?
I'm often playing the guitar keeping my fingers nimble in that way. But generally, I end up writing a song rather than, you know, I get bored playing my old songs, and I can't really play anybody else's songs, so I end up writing new ones. I read a lot, you know. I love to read, and I don't have enough time to read. There isn't enough hours in the day. I've got so much work to do, so much writing to do, so much music to listen to. It's very real, you know. My idea of a break from that. Is, you know, to dive into a good book. And at the moment, I've been reading a biography of Ted Hughes and his entire collected works of poetry. You know, it's a pretty sizable, and that leads me into other things. And then I picked up a copy of Grief is a Thing with Feathers, which is a book inspired by Ted Hughes' Crow. And I want to read that. And meanwhile, you know, I,
I'm a terrible man. I shouldn't be allowed into a bookshop because there's already piles of books all over my desk and all up next to my bed and glittering tables. And then I walk past a secondhand bookshop and come out with some more to add to it. So, yeah. Which is why, you know, I think there are too many books. There are too many books in the world already. And yet here I am attempting to add to their number. It's the curse of the reader and the writer.
Right. Does Zero, going back to Zero in sort of wrapping up, I guess, does Zero read, do you think? Does he have time to read?
Yeah, his own reviews. And he never forgets the bad ones.
Yeah. Well, is there a Neil McCormick in the Zero universe that reviews? Do you have your own sort of version of yourself in there?
He comes across a couple of critics, and I did think of going completely meta and interviewing him myself. But actually, I think that would be too far and too egotistic. I'd have to be really mean about myself, because otherwise people would think I'm just stroking my own ego with all the great questions I'd be firing at him. Yeah, there are music journalists in the book. I don't know if my music journalist friends will forgive me for the portrait of them, but because I have great sympathy for our trade, but I know that when you're on the receiving end of an interview, a lot of people look out at the people asking them questions, us, in other words, with a kind of barely disguised, or quite well disguised, but beneath the surface, a barely disguised loathing for the idiocy of the questions we fire at them.
Well, before I know you need to run, to promote the book.
I'm pacing up and down now. I've got 5 minutes before I have to dash and pick my son. So what are the questions? What's the last, the quick fires?
Yeah, I teased on Twitter about watching. You did a wonderful promo video on Unbound that folks can watch about why and where the book came from. You tell a story of, there's also some article.
One thing about the death mask.
Yeah, the face on the on the shelf.
That's me. That is me. So my dearly beloved used to be a makeup artist. She's now an acupuncturist. And when she was learning about makeup artistry way back in the mists of time, she was learning about making prosthetic masks and so on. And she wanted to experiment. And I have always been her fodder for experimentation. So I sat there and she wrapped my face in bandages and emerged with a plaster cast. And then made from that my death mask, which I then painted. And so there it stands on my desk, where I can look at myself as a corpse just to remind myself that time is running out.
that's some sort of ego crossed with death. There was some people who in our YouTube group that were asking, thinking, as I posted to them as well, and thinking maybe it was some rock star that you had the face of or whatever, and people said it looked like Michael Stipe maybe, or Aaron Paul.
I thought it looked like Aaron Paul. Yeah, from Breaking Bad.
We want to thank you, Neil, for coming on the show and answering our questions about Zero. We definitely wish you all the best in the crowdfunding campaign, and I'll say it once again, unbound.com/books/zero. Any other things you want to plug, mention? We'll have links to all the stuff you do in the show notes, of course, so people can find.
Right now, I'm just concentrating on this novel, wondering what I've got myself into. It's been a pleasure to write, and I hope we can make a success of it, so that I can write many more. You know, it's tough out here in the arts, and it's not getting any easier because, you know, we're in a moment of paradigm change, and crowdfunding has become a way that artists of any kind are having to respond to the changing dynamics. So this is my first attempt, and I'm having fun, but I have to see how it goes if we're going to have any more.
Yeah, I think I have no doubt you'll be successful here in this one, and look forward to reading the book and then seeing what else comes out next. And maybe there'll be someone else will write, I guess, a friend of yours. I don't know how this gets too meta, maybe, but a Killing Zero book will come out somehow that will be in response or something like that. But thanks again, Neil, and we look forward to chatting with you again, and we'll keep all the U2 fans, the listeners of the podcast, up to date on what's going on, and people can visit at u2.com to find out when the book is out and the crowdfunding campaign is over and all that kind of stuff. So thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you again next time.